for the title page.
Was that in the meeting? Was that in the meeting?
Because otherwise, then
I'm worried we're not going to complete the history of philosophy and religion. Because that's what this whole six systems got really big.
Hari Om Sahana Bhavatu Sahana Bhunatu Sahaveyam Karabhavahai Tejasvi Navadhitamastu Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadara Shri Vasari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare.
So starting with Tattva Vivek, part one. This is what there is that you have the in the whole Shastra Chakshus course, then the main central focus is on Prabhupada's books of Bhagavad Gita, Nectar Devotion, Nectar Instruction, and Shupanishad. Then you so there's the systematic studies, that we call it, chronological. That's the second one. Thematic. We're saying chronological. Some people have a problem with chronological. Right, you know. So, but whatever it is, it's just you're going from the front of the book to the back of the book in order. Then the thematic means you're taking different points from anywhere in the book and following that line. So that's the second. So those are the two kinds of study that Prabhupada mentions. You have to read the book, then study the book. Right? And then, along with whatever's the main Prabhupada's books, then there's always the supporting books of the acharyas that are bringing out various aspects that are there. So, in other years, they go simultaneously, but in the first course, then it's in the third year. So that's the one, that's the main course. Then you also have this history of philosophy and religion that takes through and goes through what is philosophy, you know, what are the different things that are there, and then how those get turned into all the different philosophies and religions of the world, right? And then the last part of it is the Upasampradaya. So we're studying this, our philosophy, we're studying the, means of the Dasamul, we're studying the six systems of the Vedic philosophy, then we're discussing the six systems within the Vedanta itself. Then how those things get perverted, into the modern philosophies and religions, and then how, you get these really wonky stuff, the Upasampradayas, right, like that. So this Tattva Vivek then is the part where it's showing how all these philosophies go out into the world. In other words, those who don't have a connection to the Veda, they don't know what's going on. All they know is that they're inspired. Because the point is that, we see in I think 11th canto, is that India is the central station, right, within moving through the universe. So being born in India, that means you're either coming up or coming down, or you're maintaining, right? So if you're born outside of that, means, you're going one of the other directions. And if you notice that you're inside a bucket going somewhere, then you specifically knowing where you're going. Yeah. Like that. So keep your bucket full of hollow, right? You know, yeah.
That's why I do it.
Yeah, okay, yeah. You got to get in the bucket. No, hollow is in there. Okay. Yeah. So then you're going to... So persons that are here, they're connected with the Vedas, so they have some skill, some knowledge, elements of the lifestyle, but they're not necessarily theistic. They're not specifically committed to the Vedic, right? It means they're doing it, but they're not so much of the times. Then after that, they take birth outside of India. So that's why many times, yeah, they don't know where it comes from. Just, you know, some music, some philosophy, some science, some, you know, just comes to them. It's just left over from the previous life. But normally in India, you would study it and then you'd get good at that based on how much you've been doing in previous lives. But here it just happens. You know, you're just sitting there and then suddenly the symphony comes into your head and you have to find something to write it on, right, like that. So it's just left over from before. I mean, like Prabhupada mentioned Ravi Shankar, it's 1,000 births to be able to play like he's playing. And he wasn't the best one. There were others that were much better than him. So, you know, you're even talking about more lifetimes. Does that make some sense? Right? So, therefore, they come up with all these things. So they have elements of the Vedic philosophy, but they don't connect it based on the Vedas. So they're just the various kinds of concepts and everything that are there about the soul, about God, about the material world, about the process of elevation, goals like that. Does that make sense? Okay. So, introduction. Tattvavivek Vivek was composed by Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur in 1893, a year which also saw the publication of his Jiva Dharma, Sharanagati, Gitavali, and Tattva Sutra. A sharpened blade among Vaishnav literatures, it represents a bold philosophical sally against the combined forces of history's prominent thinkers. While all the works of our previous acharyas help in assimilating Lord Chaitanya's teaching, the Tattvavivek is remarkable in its direct analysis of the world's Kaitava Dharma, maturely motivated religions. An analytical composition of Western and Eastern philosophy and religion, it identifies by name the stalwarts of atheism, skepticism, positivism, impersonalism, and myriad other misled schools of thought, then proceeds to refute their reasoning according to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's irreproachable Achintabhedaveda Tattva Darshan, a doctrine. Astonishingly, the Tattvavivek weighs in at around 100 pages. What it lacks in volume, however, it makes up for in insight. Right? Because the full explanation is already there in, as he said here, Jiva Dharma. Because that's the full discussion of the Gaudiya philosophy. So it doesn't have to fully give that, because it's already there in the other book. And then at the same time as that it's 100 pages, then that also says something about the world religions and philosophies, that's all it requires to actually deal with that. That's the other aspect. Yeah. The first part of the work serves as a theological offensive. No system of thought, no country, no era is spared in the talker's incisive analysis, scrutinized under the lens of absolute knowledge. Neither India's Charvak, nor Greece's Democritus, nor China's Yang Chu, nor France's, how do you say Comte. Okay. Nor England's Mill. That means like in, that's like a nice little village, you know, with a little creek coming, that mill. No, so even the English bread gets it, right? You know, so okay. Escape unscathed. Only a pure devotee of the Lord coming into cyclic succession could accomplish the task of subordinating the entire history of human thought with such style, persuasiveness, and concision. The second part of the Tattvavivek then proceeds to give the authoritative conclusions of the Gaudiya Vaishnava philosophy based on Srimad Bhagavatam's Chatushloki, Chaitanya Charitamrita Sanatan Siksha, and Dasamula Tattva. So when you're saying that this part one means the part one of the part one you've mentioned, or this is part one of the first installation of many parts to make up part one.
This is referring to part one as the first half of the entire book.
Okay, but on the front here it says part one.
Yeah,
what is that referring to?
The first half of the book as well.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So basically the Kaitava Dharma is the first half, and then the, you know, Gaudiya Siddhanta.
Okay, is the second. Okay. Though spanning 2,500 years of human history, Tattvavivek unfolds not chronologically, but doctrinally, adopting the same methodology used in the same author's Chaitanya Sikshamrita. It positions each belief system within the eternal pattern of consciousness evolution from animalistic to moral to liberated. The attentive reader is thus rewarded with the vision to see through the specific details propounded by any one philosopher and to perceive the underlying material conditioning from which it springs. Right. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So it's more important to be in this particular order, because then you're understanding what philosophies are happening at what time. Because otherwise, then the difficulty comes up is that if you go in chronological, you don't actually catch an understanding of the development of it. Right? So the modes of nature may make different things come out at different times, but there's actually an evolution in the consciousness, starting from the lowest level and going up to liberation. So does that make sense? So this way, because the point is when people speak, they're also not necessarily speaking at the particular time. Very few people actually know the authors they're speaking from or even quote them. Some do, most don't. Right? So the important thing is to know the philosophy itself, because then you can understand what they're saying and then what's the actual response, where it fits into the philosophical scheme, so therefore what its strengths are, what its weaknesses are. Right? Because the point is the weaknesses are always what makes it not a viable philosophy. Right? They'll take it up to a particular point and then stop. Right? As we see in the Vedic, they come up to a particular level, they stop. That's the weakness. It's not that parts that they're not talking about aren't correct. Like when we were reading yesterday, that the philosophy the Advaitins are giving about how the soul is in contact with Maya doesn't work in their own philosophy. It only works in our philosophy, because we actually believe the soul has consciousness. Well, they say he's not conscious, but at the same time it's his consciousness that goes on to the material nature that starts the process. But if he's actually pure consciousness, where he actually is not conscious, right? If that makes any sense. So then, therefore, he wouldn't start the process. So it wouldn't be viable. So much of the time is even things that they're saying, we can explain them because we know where that comes in the philosophical framework. But they don't know, because to them it just seemingly explains one part of theirs, but then another part contradicts it. Does that make sense? Right? Mm. Rather than confront such philosophies as rival schools, it connects their idea to the original Sud-Darshan system of the Vedas. Quote, modern atheists preach philosophies that are illusory and establish themselves as new propounders. They only change the name and form of an old philosophy. Tattva Vivek 117. Right? So nobody's presenting anything new. You think it's new, but it's not new. You know, you take the drink and okay, then you take a little sprig of mint and put it on and say, now it's new. It's the same drink, right? In contrast with your typical academic philosophy survey course, Tattva Vivek discourses each philosophy from its historical and geographic context and shows how their speculative conclusions are as old as consciousness itself. Right? Because there's a history why it comes up, and there's also a reason it's in that area. Right? Does that make sense? So that's how things function. Okay, so this is a quote from Sajjan Toshima. In the Western countries, very few people are civilized and intelligent. In those countries, people like Tyndall, Huxley, and Darwin are considered very learned. They are supposed to be learned because they can present old topics in a new language. In Bhagavad Gita, which appeared about 5,000 years ago, the demoniac propensities are described. It is stated therein that the theory of evolution and the theory of gradual advancement are born from a demoniac nature. Religion and Science, Sajjan Toshini. 111 means the page. Okay. Even though written over 100 years ago, Tattva Vivek is as fresh and relevant as ever. Rooted in the primeval principles of Sambandha, Abhideya, and Prayojana, its critical tools serve to dispense. With any of today's so-called modern challenges. While the author's analysis are indeed pointed and devastating, they have a conciliary intent. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur's desire was to unite all living entities under Lord Chaitanya's banner of spiritual fraternity. Right. So the point is it's not that the philosophy's wrong, it's not enough. It covers certain areas that may have an element of truth to it, but it's not actually seeing in its completeness. So it's unable to actually deliver the living entity from the miseries of the material world, which all philosophies are meant for. Right? They're meant to make you happy. That's the idea. But they're unable to do that because they don't address enough to be able to do that. You know, it's just like, okay, I cut the vegetables nice, I get them all the right size, they're all even like that. You know, I put the ghee, I put all the spices, you know, I put in the vegetables, but I don't put it on the fire. Right? So the cutting the vegetables is right, but it's not on the fire, it's not going to cook. No, no, but if you're positive and think, you know, God, then it will cook. You know? Yes, that's the problem. Yes.
Aren't some of the philosophies wrong, downright wrong?
There's always an element that is starting with a principle that may be right, but details may be all wrong. You know what I'm saying? In other words, there's an idea that the living entity is suffering. You have to explain it. Why is he suffering? And what can he do to end that suffering? That principle is okay. Then they address a certain aspect of that. That also, the principle of that may be okay, but how they perceive it, how they define it, then there's strengths and weaknesses. Right? Does that make sense? So we're not looking at it from the thing is we're right, they're wrong. The point is God's right. And if you're in line with that, you're also right. If you're not in line with that, you're wrong. So it's nothing really to do with us. You know? Does that make sense? You know, so that's the thing. Yes.
I don't quite understand how the theory of evolution contradicts with, Krishna consciousness. Like, I mean, we've got a theory of evolution as well, so...
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, but that's the real theory. The other one is, in other words, the concept that the living entity is evolving, that's fine. But the problem is there, it's the bodies are evolving, not the soul. Okay. Where's the soul in Darwinism? Right, it's in... How you say, an a-soul philosophy. There's no soul. Right? Does that make sense? So that's the difficulty, is it doesn't have that. So it's the bodies that are evolving. But, of course, even in their own discipline, right, it's based on, what is it? Certain kind of biology. That system cannot prove his theory. He's from that discipline, but his own discipline can't prove it. Right? You know what I'm saying? So, therefore, it's not viable. Right? Does that make sense?
So it's not possible that the bodies and the souls are evolving?
The bodies are pretty much the same. I mean, you could say they're devolving, you know, but I mean... You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? But the point is what's evolving? What's getting better? What can modern man do that, you know, let's say the Romans couldn't, you know? Other than be a little bit more, less self-centered.
No, I guess I'm talking about things like salamanders and axolotls. You know.
Yeah, but has one turned into the other?
Yeah, they have.
Yeah, and then they turned into, you know, a cat or an armadillo.
I guess it's not an evolution, but it's a change, like.
Yeah, but that's between those two, they change. But, you know, cats don't turn into dogs. It's not, you know, your Burmese cat, you wake up in the morning and it's Siamese, and then the next it's, you know, Vietnamese, and the next after that, then it's one of those fluffy Persians. You know what I'm saying? How does it work? It just means these are options that it can do. And they're only defining them as two different species. They may be the same species, it's just whether they want to look like this or that.
Okay. But we do recognize that species do change.
Which species change?
Like animals change.
Change means what?
Well,
it's like you're a pit bull and now everybody's kind of down on pit bulls, so you decide to turn into a cute terrier or something.
No, but maybe that fish got legs or something.
How did he get legs? What fish has got legs? But we have plenty of fish in our pukkur here, and birds come to eat them. They don't get legs and run off.
What about those fish that
What's,
have lungs and come out of the water?
Yeah, but they've always been like that. You know what I'm saying? There's this fish, it's like 300,000 years old or something, or millions of years old. And it still looks exactly the same today. You know what I'm saying? That's the point, is they don't change. They move around a little bit in there because, you know, the girl of the species likes the bigger nose. So they get a little bit bigger nose. And then after they decide enough big noses, we'll get into small nose. And they get a little smaller. But that's about it. That's not evolution. That doesn't change, you know, a polar bear into a blue whale. You know, he fell in and, you know, he couldn't get back on the land, so he turned into a whale. It doesn't work. And then he has to wait around for another one to fall in, you know, and then turn into a whale. And, oh, my God, that's another male, you know. So, okay, wait around a little bit more. Then the female falls in. Okay, then the two guys fight each other, kill each other. Then the female has to wait around. Hopefully another male falls in. You know, I mean, it's not happening. You know, I'm saying that there's little fluctuations, but that's by God's arrangement, not by their arrangement. Because if that was true, if that was, you could change, there would be no such thing as plastic surgery. Do you understand?
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't work like that.
So is a way to explain it that there are set species, but some of them are just similar to each other?
There's 8,400,000. If they're so scientific, where are the other 6 million that they don't know about? You know what I'm saying? There's millions and millions they don't know about. So the point is sometimes, see, it means sometimes a bird that's the same bird that's red, and then another is exactly the same, but it's white. They're actually two different species.
Yeah.
Because the species is the mentality. Does that make sense? You know, a certain bird. You steal cloth, you become this kind of bird. You steal red cloth, you become the red bird.
Okay.
You understand? That's all. Right? You steal grains, you become a rat. You steal scents, you become a muskrat. Right? So don't take anybody's perfume. You understand? It's just how it works. It's all by mentality. So there's 8,400,000 mentalities. So the evolution is through these mentalities. The bodies just happen to go along with them. Does that make sense? So how he's presenting it is totally atheistic, because it has nothing to do with the philosophy, nothing to do with God, nothing to do how the world universe is. It's just by chance, you know? And the point is the chance that you'd have dead matter would turn into something alive because a lightning bolt hit it, you know, just the right time, is practically, you know, it's like 10 to some ridiculous power. And then it happened this many times? That's not scientific. That's called just being stupid. You know what I'm saying? It's just really being stupid. You know what I'm saying? So it's... The problem with the science is it's atheistic element, because the point is what's the use of knowing that? What can you do with that? You know what I'm saying? Sit around and stare at your feet and wish they were different, and then maybe after three lifetimes then they'll be changed, but you're not there. Where's the continuation? Why would it? Why would each one be thinking that?
I can do whatever I want.
Yeah, so that, you know, so the point comes down is just you can do what you like. Yeah, it's just another way of being free from the control constraints of human life. You know, behaving properly and all that. You know.
One argument.
It's a good thing he never bumped into Australia, right? He just ended up out in the kosher with a bunch of turtles, right?
Dutta Karma Prabhu, he put an argument that...
Louder?
Dutta Karma Prabhu put an argument that if evolution is, as they say, where are the linking DNA?
Yeah, there's no linking.
Intermediate species.
Yeah, there aren't any intermediate. Just like, you know, between the gorilla and us, there isn't anything. you know, they keep making more and more of this and that, but you can still see the same facial features today. You know what I'm saying? They're saying this whole thing, I've seen Neanderthals, you know, like that. You move around here now and again, you see people that have those same features. You know, they're going on today. You know, so that's the thing. All these different features were always there. Right? Means millions of years ago, they're talking about, means the Manu is discussing all the fallen tribes. You know? But they were always there. So that means all these different species are there. The thing is, it's what's freaky that they don't bother about is that means how many human species are here on this planet. Because actually it means they're very different. The Poles are very different from the Germans. The Prussians were different from the Poles. You know what I'm saying? The Latvians and that, though similar, are different from them. Each country, there's a unique mentality. And within that, there's groups. Those are all technically different species. They don't get into that. They kind of stay away from that. It's there. Some discuss it. In the Smithsonian, they have a whole board where they show all that kind of jazz. But it's not something that you ever hear about.
Because they don't actually agree on what defines a species.
Yeah, so then that becomes down the thing. You know, okay, the bird has a little this and that. So, but the point is there's a mentality difference. There's a physical difference. There's all these things. But now it's all mixed, so then you start to see less of it. But it's just like, you know, you mix, what do you call it, Doberman pincer with something else real short, and you end up with a dachshund, you know? You know what I'm saying? So it just means, it's just, that's what you get. It's still a dog. But you can only mix something that's actually allowed. You can't mix something that's not allowed. Does that make sense? Because when they do all the mixing, there's a point where it stops. You can't mix it anymore. You know, generally it turns purple. So if you see any purple people, that's as far as it gets. Right? They don't get more, and you can't get farther than that. That's the end of the line. Like that. So blue can still go a little bit more. Right? Yes.
Another argument that he put was that it's like you have a luxury car and you switch off one of the items, like electric windows and things, and then you have a more standard popular car. Yeah. He's giving that, but just by observing the similarities, then they thought that this one must come from that one and that one and that one.
Yeah.
So
means you were there and it was really tall, holy that, like that, so then one day you came and it turned into an electric window. Quote, gradually, when the offensive portions of the established religions are destroyed, there will be no more differences in the bhajan performed by the various sampradayas, nor any quarrel between them. Then, as brothers, the people of all castes and countries will spontaneously chant the holy names of the Supreme Lord together. At that time, no one will hate anyone or consider others dog-eaters, nor will anyone be overwhelmed by the pride of high birth. The living entities will not forget the principle of natural brotherhood. Sajjan Toshini 4.3. Right, so that's the idea, is if you remove the things, then you're dealing with the same philosophy. Right? Yes.
Do you think he means there won't be any dog eaters left after? Or that we won't...
It says the offensive portions of the established religions are destroyed. You know.
So this is kind of like a utopian prediction.
Yeah, because the point is once you do that, because that's why it says that as time goes within the Sankirtan mission, there'll be Ekavarna, because you have one nature. So they're all following the Brahminical culture and everything like that. You know, so one mentality. Yes.
What's a dog eater? What's this big problem with them?
They eat dogs.
Yeah, but, I mean, other people eat other things.
They're supposed to eat vegetables.
I know, but other people eat like goats and cows. They're like, why is the dog eating the worst thing? And where are they? I've never seen any dogs.
Because they ate all the dogs.
There's still plenty of dogs around.
Yeah, but they don't move around. It means they move. It means if you go into the right sections of town, then they have dog on the menu.
Yeah, today?
No, yeah. I mean, it's going on. Dogs are delicacy. Why they like dogs, I don't know.
And they're like the lowest human?
Because it's a particular mentality. See, as dog eater, besides the element of eating dog, means the chandala, it's a mix between a Brahminical mentality and a Shudra mentality, but in its reversed form. So you have the maximum difference in degrees of mentality in it that's opposite to what it should be. So you have somebody with a very low-grade consciousness, but they have a very sharp intelligence. What are they going to do? They're going to make trouble. That's a chandala. Now, whether he eats a dog or not, that's another thing. You know what I'm saying? So that's why in the Vedic, one avoids the mixed varnas, just because it makes very strange mentalities.
Isn't that a lot of people today?
I mean, specifically chandalas, not necessarily like that, but you get them. You know, like that. But most people are mixed anyway. But even within the traditional cultures, no one likes mixed. You know what I'm saying? They don't like you to mix with another culture or another like that, because it produces a mentality that doesn't fit in either. You know, so it starts to upset the culture. You know what I'm saying? But when you have a culture that everybody's mixed, so then there is no standard kind of culture, so kind of everybody fits in. You know, everybody's got a spot. You know what I'm saying? The thing is to see is, if you notice here, the whole thing is consciousness. The mentality of consciousness. That's what we're focusing on. We're not focusing on the external elements, because as you mentioned, as you take out the offensive portions, that means they don't even have to give up their particular kind of rituals, as long as the portions that are against the Vedic version are removed. So it doesn't matter their dress or this or that. You know, it's not like the Eskimos who are expecting to wear dhotis. You know what I'm saying? You know, so that's the element is that what the problem is, what gets in the way of God consciousness. Does that make sense? So in the religion, so many things get in the way of God consciousness. If you say God's a person, and then what does he look like? Well, he has no form. That gets in the way of developing a relationship with him. Because then you won't develop a relationship with him. You just go to him to get what you want. It's not about developing a relationship with God. People want to go to heaven to do what? Not hang out with God. Does that make sense? But even to the point where I've even heard it's a discussion amongst the theologians that the God talked about, that Adam and Eve walked with, that they're actually with God and interacting with God, is not actually the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Because then if that's the Supreme Personality of Godhead, then going to heaven is not about me going there with my family and my dog, you know, Sly was with the stone, right? Yeah. Yeah, but who is with the dog?
They ate the dog.
Oh, they ate the dog. Okay. So they go to there, and it's just you and your family and hanging out all day. And God just is the doorkeeper. You know what I'm saying? You know, so how is that actually an elevation of human consciousness? You know, it may elevate to the finer aspect of karma, but it's still based on the bodily concept of life. It's still not based on the soul. Why do you have to bury the body? Because you're supposed to take it with you, right? Does that make sense? So the thing is, if it's a matter of taking it with you, then why do they dig up the mummies? You know, that's the body they're going to take with them, you know? Anyway, I think you're supposed to be... What was it? I think it's the south side of Jerusalem is where you want to be buried. Like that. That's the first cemetery to go. Like that. Does that make sense? So it's been transformed from a transcendental subject matter into quite a mundane subject matter.
So what did are you connecting this to the dog eater somehow?
Yeah, because you're worried about them eating dogs rather than the mentality.
Well, I mean, how did they get that mentality and the intelligence? Doesn't intelligence, wouldn't it bring them to the point of trying to get self-reliance, therefore developing their consciousness?
Means how? How does dog eating get you to that consciousness?
Well, you said it's got nothing really to do with dogs. It's that they have a high intelligence but a low consciousness.
Yeah, but their high intelligence is used for doing low class things.
Okay.
All right. Does that make sense?
It's bizarre, but okay.
But that's what a chandala is.
Okay.
That's why they're pointed out. Because after that, you have even more mixes that are even worse. But that's one of the ones that's clearly identifiable. You know? Because they're active. They're kind of move within the system, but they really make a mess of it. While other ones are so far outside the system that they don't even really count. Right? Because you have lower than dog eaters. The antyavasayin, that's just like, even amongst the outcasts, they're considered outcasts. Yes.
Or is the principle of natural brotherhood, is that a Chinti Veda Tattva?
It's not so much that, it's more of that Vaishnavism. It's just, you know, all Vaishnavas, because everybody is the servant of the Lord. So therefore everybody has something in common, because there's going to be differences in what service is done, what realm you're in, this and that, but there's common ground. Is that... Is that actually working?
Yeah.
Wow, impressive. It is our hope that the reader will enjoy this translation of Tattva Vivek by Sriman Kusakratra Prabhu and use these philosophical and religious insights to preach Krishna consciousness boldly. Jaja. Who wrote this introduction? The royal introduction writer wrote this introduction.
It depends on where you call it.
Yes. Did you like it or not like it?
Like it.
Means fully like it. Not that after we tell you who it is, then you drop it.
Then I have a question.
He's still alive, right?
Yeah, no, he's still alive. He's still sitting there. Nobody's thrown any rocks yet. Or anything. I mean, wait till he leaves the class today. Okay, Tattva Vivek. Pratama Anubhava. First realization. Text 1. Jayati Sachi Ananda Rasanubhava Vigraha. Prochayet Satchidananda Nubutir Yat Prasadata. Glory to Sri Krishna Chaitanya, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, in whose form rest eternity, knowledge, bliss, and the taste of nectar. By his mercy, this book, which bears the title Satchidananda Bhuti, directly seeing the Supreme Personality of Godhead, in whose form rest eternity, knowledge, and bliss, has been written. Okay, footnote 1. In this Mangalacharna verse, the word rasa is significant. But Sri Krishna is often referred to as Satchidananda Vigraha, Sri Brahma Samhita 5.1. Here, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur glorifies Lord Chaitanya as Satchidananda Rasanubhava Vigraha. Because right, as Satchidananda, that's his nature. That means, yeah, you could say his existence. But then it's that tasting, that nectar, that is what he does in that state of existence. Right, so that brings out something special there. One possible reason for this choice of words can be gleaned from Srup Damodar's Kadacha, wherein each member of the Pancha Tattva is declared to embody a particular type of shelter for the devotee. Gauranga Mahaprabhu is the Rasa Ashraya, Nityananda Prabhu the Prema Ashraya, Garadhar Pandit Bhava Ashraya, Advaita Charya Pancharatrika Vidhi Ashraya, and Srivas Thakur the Shuddha Nam Ashraya. By taking shelter of Lord Chaitanya, the living entity can attain to the highest spiritual rasa. Right? Because all those things together is going to be for tasting rasa. Right? Because the point is, you're on the platform of prema, is tasting rasa. Rasa, well, prema means the love. Rasa means the what is experienced through the exchange of that love. Right? Because love, prema is a generic element that everyone, all devotees have love for Krishna. But rasa means that particular way in which it's expressed. And then the taste gained by that interaction. Right? In other words, prema is the prayojana. But rasa is based on the aspect of interaction, is abhideya. Because abhideya is the central feature, because it's through abhideya that you taste prema. So depending upon your relationship, then you taste that prema through that activity. Bhava is the ecstasy that is appreciated in that. And at the same time, as we can take that down as the particular bhava or mood and specifics of the rasa. But you can also take it that that means the whole devotional process from shraddha all the way through prema is actually, because that's based, that is the manifestations of bhava, it is various points of development. So that means that's then by the grace of Gadadhar Pandit. It means that you're worshipping of the deity, so worshipping the Lord through the rules and regulations, because he's Mahavishnu. Yes.
It's also commented that Advaita Acharya, he called down Lord Chaitanya by worshipping Shalagram with Tulsi and with Ganga, and that actually it's said that he perfectly worshipped Lord Ganga according to Narada Pancharatra. So he's the one to take shelter of
the process. Shudanam is that, you know, the proper chanting. Because you see that Srivas Thakur's house, that's where the kirtan would go on. So in other words, all these elements. So in other words, it means chanting the pure name, proper worship of the deity, then the aspect of that goal of prema, but, you know, following the process that's given, like that, and then through that, by the Lord's grace, one will be situated in relationship with the Lord and be able to appreciate and taste that rasa. Is that okay? By taking shelter of Lord Chaitanya, the living entity can attain to the highest spiritual rasa. Yet, considering that the Tathavivek is meant as a philosophical treatise, what role does rasa-anubhava, experience of rasa, play here? Knowledge has three parts: jigyasa, inquiry; sangraha, assimilation; and ashvadana, taste. For the bhava-bhakta, inquiry and assimilation have been completed previously during the period of sadhana-bhakti by understanding the meaning of devotional literatures. For the Bhava Bhakta, only the tasting portion of knowledge remains. Chaitanya Shikshamrita 5.3, page 196. Right? Inquiry, assimilation, and then taste. Because you inquire, then you understand, then you take that, you practice it, so it becomes assimilated. When there's realization, that is assimilation. Right? Then one can taste. Right? Then one tastes what's being offered. That taste which arises naturally in a person on the level of prema is called rasa. The discussion of rasa is only a description of how the various elements combine in the different rasas. It's not part of sadhana. Therefore, if anyone says that he will teach you the sadhana of rasa, he is an impostor or a fool. Rasa is not a matter of understanding, but a matter of tasting. The two preliminary stages of knowledge are inquiry and reception. If these are not completed, the final stage of knowledge, experience, or tasting will not arise. Jigyashvara nu na vadhi tattva sutra.
I have a question.
Yes.
So is this the proper application of the often used phrase, there are some things that you cannot explain in words? Is rasa like that?
Yeah, but the point is you can describe all the aspects about it. Its situations, its interactions, its what forms you can see. You can explain the sti bhav, you can explain all the bhavs, but the taste of that you can't explain. you know, other than Rupa Goswami says, when you do taste, then, you know, the nectar of the holy name, then you want millions of tongues, and when it enters the ear, you want millions of ears, like that. So he can only give you an idea, right? You know, so it's just, you know, nobody, when they hear something really great, you know, they don't say, I wish I had millions of ears. They just think, this sounds nice, you know, like that, you know. So yes.
So taste doesn't come before we complete the sattva part?
I mean, some element of taste, but, you know, we're talking about taste, and then there's taste. You know, we have taste, that's why we're doing it. And even a drop is greater than the material world, because the material world, its taste is actually illusory. It doesn't exist. This rock, you know, likes this rock, you know. Hey, give me some, what do you call it? What are all the little flecks and stuff like that? You know, all the mica and stuff. Hey, give me some mica. You know, like that. It's where's the taste? I identify with it, and so if this rock touches that rock, I'll be happy. So when they touch, oh, I'm so happy. That's what's going on in the material world. Does that make sense? So there isn't any. So even a drop, when we're talking about, so there is taste, of course. You know, just like, why are you taking it up? Because the taste is better than something else. That's why you develop faith, right? That's why you want to associate. That's why you want to practice. So taste is going throughout, but in its mature form, you know, in prema, then it's so far beyond anything here. So these things are so far beyond, we don't really identify with it. It's so great. You know, we would just say it's nice if I just had a little facility. But in the Upanishads, it describes one unit of human happiness, you know, a full unit of human happiness as being unrivaled emperor of the world. It takes that as one unit, right? And then it just goes up and shows how each level of existence in the other planets is 100 times that. Right, you know, all those yakshas, rakshasas, that's 100 times this. Right? Then you go above that, then you have just the citizens on the planets, heavenly planets, is 100 times that. Right? Then the actual office holders is 100 times that. You know, and then the main ones who run the universe, like, you know, Varuna and Yamaraj, and like that, it's 100 times that. Indra's 100 times that. Then Brihaspati, that's 100 times that. Prajapatis are 100 times that. Brahma's 100 times that. And that happiness of Brahma, this happiness of Brahma, which is, you know, we can say hundreds, you know, thousands and thousands of times of that happiness, then that's only considered a drop compared to the ocean of happiness of being liberated. Right? Just being back on our normal tathasta position. But then that's considered to be a fraction of a portion of a drop of the unlimited ocean of bhakti. So then that's millions and millions of times greater than that. So we are getting taste, but it's just what's available is even more. Does that work?
It's a bit depressing.
Why would it be depressing? No, it means what you're getting now is going to get better.
Yeah.
means, but what it's talking about is material taste. When we say the king, that's material. You know, so in other words, the kid on his skateboard with his iPod, it doesn't even, you know, that doesn't count. You know, and probably has a Nano anyway.
Shuffle.
I know it's in here somewhere. Yes.
If it's such an unlimited ocean of bliss, bhakti is such an unlimited ocean, why does it seem that through so many years of sadhana or so much endeavor, it's just sometimes so dry? And, you know, like...
Because we're still... Because we're looking to the material for our taste.
Yeah. Why is that?
We're used to that. You know what I'm saying? In other words, it's comfortable. You know that this works like this, and I have this idea if I deal in this way, then that will give me the results. So by habit, then we just involve ourselves in the material. Does that make sense? Means if you look at it, see, as we're looking at it, devotional service is dry. No, it's the material world is dry. All it is that if you're surrounded by people who think this is a great party, it's not a great party. You know, people are so drunk they can't recognize each other. They're puking all over the place. They've knocked over a few vases. You know, already the guy's mother's freaking out. And when they wake up in the morning, they don't even know what they did. They have to ask their friends, you know, did I have a good time? You know what I'm saying? But the motive passion is there that we think, you know, that if you're doing this, you'll be happy. So it's just what we're used to. So the point is by associating with devotees who have that faith that this is, you know, what is actually going to give the happiness, then we develop more in that way. Right? Because it's not anything else. It's the chanting and performing of Shuddha Bhakti.
And even after performing, even say doing directly those activities of chanting, japa or kirtan, directly engaging in those things and still feeling that dryness, you know, like not.
It's the example is given that sugar, rock candy is sweet, right? But someone who has jaundice, to them it tastes bitter, right? Or if you're getting a little better, it just tastes neutral. It just, there's no sweetness at all. But if you continue taking it, then it will purify the disease, and you'll actually be able to taste the sweetness that's actually there. So the problem's not the process, the problem's us. So it's just a matter of how much taste you get from it, just you know that that's how much we're contaminated, right? And so the idea is that the acharyas are saying this process works, so you just stick to it, and you'll see with time it'll come, you know? Because anything, you have to stick to it. Right? Means, how old is a guy when he becomes the president? Right? Yeah. When did he start? Right? Junior high school. Right? Running for class president and this and that and, you know, like that. So, you know, by the time they're 60, 70 years old, right, then they... Like, I was, like, shocked. I was looking at the thing. Nixon was born in, like, I think, before World War I. Like that. He had been through and been all this and been serving three presidents, this, that. I never would have given him that much credit. Whatever. All these kinds of things. And that, and then finally becomes the president, right? So it takes a long... Yeah, that just takes a long time. Material platform. The guy is sitting there, you know, and, you know, he has his plans. And then finally when he's, you know, 60, 70 years old, then he's, you know, doing well. He's sitting on the top of his, you know, big company and everything like that. It just takes time. You know, so we're looking for a result that's greater than any of this, but is actually easier to get than any of this. Right? The amount of work that's there is so much. So probably makes the point we should be willing to work like the materialist works. If we work with that determination, then you'll get it. The point is we think, because the point is that the guy says, well, I've been doing business for a while, I'm not getting any money, does this process actually work? No, the process works. Economics is economics. It's just you have to stick to it. Does that make sense? Does that...
Dhyananda Maharaj makes a comment that he says how hilarious, he used another term, he says that we are tired of Maya, so we turn to Krishna conscious, and we look at Krishna conscious, but we actually look for Maya, and then we decide that it's not worth, so I'll go back to Maya.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. You know, yeah, just one gets distracted. Because the point is it's the sadhana is the regulated activities, the recommended activities, but to perform them free from karma and jnana favorably towards Krishna, that's what one's trying to do. You know what I'm saying? So it's just, that's why it's sadhana, it's practice, because one may do it right, one may not do it right. So then one tries it again, then again. So every day one's chanting one's rounds. Does that make sense? Yeah. You know, it's like the guy gets the flowers, he gives them to the girl, and he, you know, and she's very happy, and then he tells her, you know, it's, I wanted to give you, express my appreciation, you know, but, you know, it would be really nice if he'd stop doing this weird thing. What result will he get? But he got the flowers, they were the right flowers, she liked those kind of flowers, you know, it was a very nice situation and everything. You understand? You don't understand. Attitude is important.
Attitude.
I mean, unless your name is Tood. Hey, attitude. Come on.
It's a matter of like clean, clear, making that attitude clean, like pleasing.
The pleasing is the thing. Clean will come. If you're trying to make it pleasing, it will automatically become clean. But in other words, we don't have to worry about the purificatory part of the devotional service. We have to worry about doing it nicely for Krishna. Right? Because what's not nice for Krishna is when we are worried about the material. Like if we're doing something like, say, leading the kirtan and worrying about if everyone's going to like the kirtan and, you know, and if afterwards they're going to say that was a great kirtan, then it's not, that devotional element is lacking. No one's performing the kirtan. Right? Does that make sense? So then the problem comes is then we're going to say, why don't I get the taste? How come today's kirtan wasn't so good? Because when it was good, it's when you didn't worry about those things. Does that make sense? So that's the thing. So if we're not getting, then we just know that it's due to the impurities. And so if we just stick to the process and do it nicely, the impurities will go. Does that make sense? So that's why there's so many examples given in the story form of devotees who have taken this up and who have come to that perfect platform. Right? It's worked. So that we get that inspiration. So here, all these things of looking, analyzing it, you know, the idea is not to make one depressed. The idea is to inspire that, you know, this is what is going on and this and that. Does that make sense? Does that work? Sure.
Yeah, I was thinking about that Bhajan Bhaktivinoda Thakur Kabe Habebo Sayyidina Amar.
Yeah.
It's a good meditation.
Yeah, so it's just a matter of if you desire it, then basically you're there. But if you don't desire it, then, you know. You know, so that's the thing is that. But if you're in the association of the devotees, you're performing the devotional activity, you're still rightly situated. You know, you're in the right place doing the right thing. So it's just a matter of time before you notice that. You know, so that's the nice thing about devotional service. However you put it together, it still works. You know what I'm saying? So by doing devotional service in the association of devotees, then one advances. If one is, you know, very committed to, conscious of, and that, you advance quicker. Like, the process works. It's just a matter of if you follow the things that they're recommending, it works quicker. And so if it's working slower, then you just know one has to focus more. That's all. And it's just a matter of practice. Okay.
So Maharaj, it seems that situating oneself in the mode of goodness is very conducive to the things you've mentioned.
It is, but if you focus on the mode of goodness, then you'll miss devotional service. Because otherwise, the smartas, they are situated in goodness. Mm-hmm. It means you go to their house, clean, well organized, everything's like that. Do everything paka according to the shastra. So you're not going to get much more mode of goodness than that. But they miss the point of the devotional service, so you have to be careful of that. It means, in other words, the recommendations of the shastras are automatically in the mode of goodness. Because pure goodness means mode of goodness that's done without any material desire. That's pure goodness. Right? So that's the natural state of the spiritual world. So you get that state here, it's the mode of goodness, but it can be followed, not connected to the Lord. That's when we call it a mode of nature. But when it's being followed to please the Lord, then it's not a mode of nature, it's pure goodness, it's beyond the modes. You know what I'm saying? So, in other words, one's aware of it, so one tries to incorporate those things, but one doesn't just focus on that. Otherwise, then, one, it'll be very difficult, you know, unless you have that kind of a background in the first place. Right, and the second thing is that, you know, one will miss the point of bhakti. You know what I'm saying? So it's not a separate. One analyzes the mode of goodness so you know what's correct, what's good, what's proper. Does this make sense?
Yeah, you mentioned that because the mode of goodness, it allows that to be present, right? To be focused.
Yes.
That element. Which
yes, but see, because we don't say don't focus on it doesn't mean you don't do it. Uh-huh. It's just like the cook is using the pan. He's aware of the pan, but is he focusing on the pan?
No.
He's focusing on what's in the pan. Okay. But he knows enough about the pan so that the stuff in the pan stays in the pan. Right? So in other words, that pan is the proper place in which cooking can go on. But it's not all about the pan. But I mean, of course, the commercials will make it all about the pan. You just have this pan, and then everything just happens like that. But it's not. It's all about the cook. Right? Does that make sense? So the mode of goodness is the situation in which we function. But it's not about the mode of goodness. It's about the devotional service. Does that make sense? Yeah. Yes.
I had a question about this inquiry, assimilation, and taste. Could we say that corresponds to Shravana, Manana, Nididhyasana?
I would say is that the Jigyasa inquiry will be the Shravana. And the Sangraha will be the process of manana to that realization. You know, that would be there. Because the taste would not be a process. The taste is actually just what one's gained from it. So someone with that realization has that value, so therefore they get the taste. Does that make sense? So by shravanam, by manana, means you're contemplating it, and practicing it, then you'll actually get to the point where you'll assimilate it. Mm-hmm. Right? So realization means you've assimilated what you've heard.
Right?
Does that make sense? But you get that through that practice. Mm-hmm. You know, so you hear, then you contemplate and practice, that gives you, then it becomes assimilated.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Okay.
I would tend to take it that way. Then one can taste what one's doing.
Right.
Yeah. You know, this is also why Prabhupada was saying that Radhakund is not for sadhana, it's for tasting. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not so much for preaching, it's for tasting. Right. That was the... What is commonly called knowledge is either inquiry or reception, but not tasting. Chaitanya Shikshamrita 7.1 to page 266. All right, so you're inquiring... You're receiving that, you're assimilating that, but taste is then applying that. So this is continuing, right? The next page. Okay, so I'll end here. Continue with the footnote tomorrow. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Shri Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivinoda ki, Janatai Gaur Premi.